Welcome back to Pod Save the World. Thank you guys for tuning in as always. I want to talk a little bit about Syria for a minute. There's a lot of talk out of Washington lately about the gains our military has made against ISIS in Syria. And while that is true, that we have taken back a lot of territory from ISIS, the reality is the war in Syria is getting worse. If you're a civilian living on the ground there, you are getting bombed by the regime day in and day out. You are caught in fighting between regime forces and rebel forces. It is a horrific situation. And the way we know about how bad the situation is brave journalists and photographers that go in and document what's happening. That is a role my guest today is very familiar with. His name is Jonathan Alperi. He has documented conflict zones across the planet. And in our interview today and in his book, he talks about what it was like to get kidnapped by rebel forces for 82 days in Syria. It is a harrowing story. He talks about what it was like being held by these people, how he got out, and what he has done upon returning home to try to help others who are taken captive like he was. I think you'll enjoy the interview, and thanks again for tuning in. My guest today is Jonathan Alperi. He's a photojournalist and author who has shot photos in at least 9 conflict zones. His book, The Shattered Lens, A War Photographer's True Story of Captivity and Survival in Syria, recounts the 81 days he spent in Syrian rebel captivity in 2013. Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the show and joining me today.
Thank you.
Okay, so you were on your third assignment in Syria in 2013, when suddenly you found yourself handcuffed, blindfolded, beaten and held captive for nearly 3 months by a group of Syrian rebels. You had reported from a whole bunch of dangerous places before. How did this trip take such a disturbing turn with you being kidnapped by these individuals?
Well, first, to answer this question, it's important to understand that different conflicts have different kinds of danger levels. Mm-hmm. And Syria was at a very high level in terms of the possibilities of getting killed or kidnapped. And the reason is because this was a very hotly contested, still is a very hotly contested conflict where you have multiple players involved, foreign and domestic players. And when you have these kinds of conflicts that are desperate in some fashion, all rules are out. And therefore, kidnappings are a good way to fund your rebel group or to fund whatever agenda you might have.
Yeah. So, speaking to the risk, so, I mean, you were very honest in the book. You went in this pretty clear-eyed about the risks. You write about going to a lecture by a very experienced war reporter named Sebastian Younger and asking him, hey, what do you think about going to Syria? And he said point blank, it's just too dangerous there now. Why did you think it was important to go anyway and document what was happening when, you know, in particular, when you also discuss how like cell phone cameras and the availability of video has changed the way conflict zones are documented and photographed?
It's an interesting question. Covering the war in Syria was, and I can testify that for most of us who went in to cover it, was also a personal challenge. Mm-hmm. Because when you're a war reporter, you're also kind of like an athlete. You want to expand the envelope as much as you can and see where your threshold is in terms of fear that you might have or how close you want to get to death, and basically look at it in the eyes and then decide whether or not this is for you as a profession or you should be covering this war, you shouldn't. And Syria was a good catalyst for that because I was able to gradually cover from wars are worse and worse and worse. And even when you're inside a conflict zone, then you can decide whether or not you want to go closer to the fighting or you don't, or you want to go to an area that's safer or more dangerous. And Syria was a very good teaching experience for that. And this war was actually my 12th war. And wow. I've covered 13 in total. And Syria was definitely one of the most dangerous assignments I've ever had to cover.
And that's something you talk about in the book, which is that, you know, the sort of the best photos that come from a conflict zone are closer and closer and closer to the front, you know, sort of soldiers actually in action. How do you determine mentally when you should be pushing to get closer versus when you feel like it may not be safe?
Well, I mean, no photos is worth your life.
Yeah.
And therefore, you have to take calculating risks in terms of, is this picture worth taking if I'm going to cross that street and maybe get killed by a sniper on the way?
Right.
Is it worth it? Now, every war reporter, or especially photojournalists, especially photographers, have different levels in terms of their abilities to operate and take these risks. But if you want to take good pictures, it's true, you do have to get closer. And that's, you know, many would agree with that. While a reporter writes can be further behind the line and just get information and gather it, the photographer and the cameraman, they have to be on site to get the images. And if there is combat is kind of like the tip of the spear, because you have wars, many different things, from covering, you know, refugee camps to destructions, things, or maybe things that happened a bit in the past. But when you're in combat, that's the ultimate version of war, because you're in it when it's actually forming and happening. And then, of course, it's the most dangerous. And this is really then you can get the feel of it. But it doesn't mean that's where you'll get the best pictures.
Right. No. Well, it was interesting reading the book. I mean, it seems like I came away thinking you were more a student of history and war than a student of photography, even. Is that a fair characterization?
No, it is. And I've always been very straightforward about that publicly. Most photographers will tell you I want the story to be told. I have a lot more, a very different approach, and partially because I was raised differently, in the sense that history has always been a very strong sense and have been shaped intellectually. And photography is the medium that allowed me to experience historical moments, and what better ways to experience history than conflict, because wars actually shape nations, and as a European, that's very true.
Right.
And that's important. And photography allowed me to experience it. Turns out I could take a good picture, and I've had a very good career doing that. Do I consider myself purely as a photographer? I do not. I mean, that's part of it. It's part of the mosaic. But there's also a version of me which is, I want to experience these historical moments and bring it to me first and live it and become that person, and then expand from that experience to others and say, this is why history is tragic and we have to remember that.
Right, right. So some of you could sort of walk us through the sequence of events that sort of led to your capture. You entered through Lebanon, I believe?
Yes. To go to Syria, you had different ways. Turkey was the most common because it was safer,
right,
and just easier to be smuggled through the lines and the borders and go into the rebel zones. Lebanon is trickier because Lebanon is controlled mostly by Hezbollah, and dealing with them, it's not that much better than dealing
right.
with Islamists on the other side.
Right.
So they're also pretty tough and very well organized and very well trained. And but I decided to go through Lebanon because I wanted to do something a bit different and cover an area that wasn't covered as much.
Mm-hmm.
And I had good contacts in Lebanon, so I put two and two together and my decision was made.
So, you know, you wrote the people who ultimately captured you and were holding you were under the umbrella of the Free Syrian Army. How did you figure that out? How did they actually take you?
Well, I knew where I was going at first, before I was kidnapped. I mean, when I was in Lebanon.
Right.
So I knew the FSA, Free Syrian Army, was more or less in control of that area in the Kalamoun Mountains. And knowing that, you kind of know who you might be dealing with, even though you know the rebel groups are very separated and they have different understanding of how they should be fighting this war. But I was smuggled from Lebanon in a town called Arsal, which at the time, and that's a small town in northern Lebanon, was controlled by pro-FSA groups, let's just put it that way.
Pro-rebel groups.
Yeah, who were anti-Bashar al-Assad,
right,
mostly. And they were surrounded by Hezbollah, mostly. So you go through, and then I got into this town called Yabrut, which is, at the time, the big hub they controlled, the rebels, that is. And I was there, and I was covering the fighting from there, and that was my base of operation.
Right. You're very clear about how terrifying this was. Immediately, there were mock executions. They were firing a pistol right next to your head. I mean, in that moment, did you think, this is it? I'm not coming back from this trip?
Not always. It's very strange. I would say you do not think that terrible things are going to happen to you. And maybe that's a sense of survival. I'm not sure. So if you're being executed or mock executions, like you say, which is the right term, you don't think it's going to happen. And partially because I was covering the war from their side and you're trying to be rational. So you're trying to rationalize everything and you say, well, wait a minute. I'm covering your side, I'm risking my life, I'm telling your story, but you're still going after me. That doesn't make sense.
Right.
Obviously, rules of in war don't apply. Logic has a different meaning.
Right.
But you also try to reassure yourself. So there's a lot of psychological work you're doing on yourself at the time.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So an interesting sort of footnote or side note is you were able to get into Syria because of the help of a fixer. And I bet that's a term people listening haven't necessarily heard before. But they are critical for a war correspondent, really for any foreign correspondent. If you're in China reporting for the New York Times, you probably have a fixer who can connect you with the right people and translate and do all the things you need. In your book, you have a description of a fixer that I love. You said, you call them, quote, sort of a cross between a foster brother and Virgil leading Dante through the various circles of Inferno. What did you mean by that? Who are these people? Like, what did they do for you?
Well, that's because they do everything for you. Okay. So they fix things for you, from translating to you need a bathroom, whatever you might need. So you kind of like, it's kind of like a parent, but who has your life in their hands. And they also, more importantly, have contacts who allow you to go be in with a specific rebel group. So they'll facilitate these connections. That's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Also, they know the law of the land very well. They know where to go. So they supply their overall thing. And they're very crucial to our work. You're very right. They're crucial. Yeah.
How do you find a good fixer from a bad fixer? I assume there's no fixer Yelp reviews or like...
There should be.
That's
like, a good idea, actually. Maybe we should start doing that.
I think we just invented a business.
Yeah,
I'm telling anybody.
Five stars, go. Two stars is not worth it.
No good. So how'd you find this guy? Like, did it ever seem just crazy to you that you're putting your life in the hands of someone you maybe just met?
No, it's a very good question. You don't just meet people. You prepare weeks ahead. I mean, you do prepare your trip. Or if you don't have that much time, you can ask other journalists. Even though in my profession, it's very competitive, like any profession, but same for us. And we would still help each other out. If anybody tells me, do you have a good guy on the ground, doesn't matter who he is, what agency, whoever he works for, I would help him, because that's a question of safety and that's just the right thing to do. So in this case, I had two fixers. The first one was a good one. That was through my contacts in Lebanon. And the second one, I decided to trust while I was on site to go to another area where they were fighting. And I believe that's him who facilitated my kidnapping. But, you know, you make mistakes. I mean, I've been covering wars for 15 years and you can still make mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. I'm honestly amazed that it works out the right way more often than not in some of these places, given what you were saying earlier about the enormous revenue you can make from kidnapping for ransom.
No, it's true. But Syria was, but the Middle East in general is tricky as a Westerner, always has been. That's nothing new. It's worse now, however. And it's tough because there's... fixers are, you know, they're there for the money, of course, but like you say, there is always a middleman that plays a role in terms of the kidnapping when it comes to renegotiations to try to get you out. Everybody takes a cut. It's just pure and simple business. So basically, when you're kidnapped, you become merchandise. You're not so much a human being anymore.
Right.
And that's exactly what I tried to portray in the book, where I tried to be more humane and therefore have a better condition.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you describe in pretty brutal detail the physical and psychological torture your captors put you through. There were beatings. One guy broke two of your ribs, the mock executions we discussed. But it did seem like your relationship evolved over time. You were able to earn their trust, maybe make some of them like you and sort of like seek out your company. How did that happen?
It's a good question. Well, my mother raised me in a specific way that allowed me to be very resilient to things. And I believe that that was very helpful, number one. Number two, it was always a struggle. I had two different personalities in me at the time. One was like, I just want to go out and kill them. And I had opportunities to do so.
Right.
Just take a machine gun. I can use them, no problem. And just take these guys out. That was...
For those listening, you're a pretty big guy. You nearly went to the Olympics for swimming, so you could, you know, have the upper hand at times.
Right, but then I would have gone killed right after by taking a few guys out. But so that's partially a fantasy that you have.
Right.
But then you really have to pull yourself back together and be like, this is not what you should be doing. And of course, one of the many things that I did is to make sure that they would like me. So I spent a lot of time being very nice to them, but not in a hypocrite, more like trying to help them with things. And,
right.
you know, they would be curious about certain things and just automatically jump in that and just give them all the details they want
right.
in order to be curious about my life back home. And obviously the base subject is women.
Right.
As any places at any time on the planet and amongst men, that is. And that was always a big curiosity for them, especially for the young ones
yeah.
who are all virgins, obviously. So if you're able to exploit these cracks and then you go right in these cracks and you can expand and just then you hope that they might forget about your conditions
right.
of being kidnapped for an hour or two, and that's
right.
helpful.
Right. Yeah, I mean, what you endured is in no way funny, but some of the scenes you described are kind of just bizarre. It was almost like proximity and boredom just drove everybody crazy. You taught one captor how to dance to J-Lo and Pitbull. You had to explain to another what foreplay was by demonstrating with a pillow after yeah. he demanded you do so.
Yeah.
You taught another guy how to swim. Could you relax in those moments, or were you always just a captive, terrified?
It's interesting. These moments you describe, you do feel free for a minute, and you automatically, I mean, it's a survival thing. I'm not sure where your brain rewires itself almost, and then you almost have a good time. And when it came to the swimming, when I was in the pool the first time and they filled it up, I really felt like I was almost in the summer camp because the weather was incredible. Bombs were dropping constantly, but it was a very nice weather. And you're in the pool and you're swimming. It's a very odd moment. It's almost
yeah.
surreal.
You had to teach what sounded like the biggest, fattest, hairiest guy how to swim. When he first got in the pool, he just sort of sank like a rock, right?
Yeah, he was a warlord, and apparently he felt like he needed to improve some skills with swimming, and he didn't know how to swim. So, yeah, he started sinking rather. So I grabbed him, and I've been playing water polo for years, so I just tried water really well. So I just like kind of holding him. And yeah, he's not a very attractive guy to look at with swim trunks. Anyway, but everybody was making fun of him because, you know, he's a warlord and he's in a very compromising position ultimately. And yeah, and by the end he could swim. I never fully understood why he wanted to do that. But when they heard I swam because I would talk about it, I think they saw this as something very strange somehow because no one really learns how to swim in that mm-hmm. part of the world. It
just yeah.
doesn't happen. So I think they were curious. And when they saw me swim, because there was the first time when I got in that pool 2 days before, then that's probably how it happened.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You live for planning the perfect trip. The thrill of comparing hotels, scoring that impossible reservation, and piecing together an unforgettable itinerary. You already think like a travel advisor, so why not just be one? Fora is a modern travel agency built for people who love to plan vacations and help others travel well. As a Fora advisor, you'll be set up for success with best-in-class training, powerful booking tools, and a vibrant global community of experts sharing real insider tips. Fora helps you turn your love of planning vacations into a business with a flexible, meaningful stream of income, with commission on every hotel, cruise, and activity you book. And with access to more than 7,000 preferred partners, you'll unlock VIP perks like upgrades, resort credits, and late checkout, giving you and your clients the kind of elevated travel experiences regular travelers simply don't get. Getting started is as easy as booking trips for people you already know. Become a Fora advisor today at foratravel.com/earn. That's FORA travel.com/earn.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
You know, in the book, you managed to remain remarkably calm. It's like you almost seemed like you had some techniques to do so, like not thinking about home, not daydreaming about an ex-girlfriend or family necessarily, like staying in the moment. Was that something you had figured out earlier in life, or did you just kind of decide in that moment, this is how I'm going to make it through this?
Nothing can ever prepare you for being kidnapped. It's like experience war, let's say a fight the first time. You're curious about it, so you know, it sounds romantic and sexy, and then it happens, and then you really know if this is for you or not. When it happened to me in 2004, my first big firefight, then I knew I was meant for that. It was built in me.
Where were you in this firefight?
It was in the Republic of Georgia, and it was probably August or September 2004. And I was very drunk, and because they were going on an assault, drinking vodka heavily, and they're like, here, have some too, it'll be good for you. And it does remove a lot of your inhibitions, as it would if you, I guess, you're at a bar and you want to talk to a woman, especially if you're drunk. But so you go, and there's bullets, you know, going around, and you're drunk, which is very stupid because you're being careless. Anyway, I did that, and
I mean, the other thing that would have driven me insane, I mean, you said a minute ago, you don't know why this guy wanted to learn to swim, but he did. It didn't make any sense. It seemed like nothing they did made sense. They moved you from one place to another. They brought in people who told you you'd be let go and they were full of shit. You know, that would happen time and time again. Like that irrationality of it all would make me crazy.
It's because you have to reapply yourself in the context of being in a war zone. So if you're home, then these lies that you're mentioning, yeah, it doesn't compute well. But however, if you're in the combat zone, then everything changes. Mm-hmm. And even if you're a nice guy and you're covering their side, therefore you're kind of taking their side in essence, and they're still going after you, and therefore they're doing bad publicity because I'm a well-known international shooter, so this would come out eventually, and it did when I was released. It really makes the Syrian rebellion look very bad, and a lot of people started, and then James Foley was killed. So, yeah. But to them, it doesn't matter. The war effort is what matters the most. Mm.
Finally, you know, you were moved several times. There were false promises, like I mentioned. Finally, a rich Syrian connected to the government essentially bought your freedom. You know, do you have a sense of why he did that? What this guy maybe got out of getting you out of captivity?
It was all very political. Originally, he was looking for two other French journalists who had been kidnapped. And he was kind of spitting in a wrong hole. So my luck was incredible because he ended up getting in contact with the rebel group who had me. And he said, well, I'm looking for these two guys. Do you have them? It's like, no, we don't. But we have this guy.
it's like car shopping.
Yeah, exactly. Who do you want? And he's like, well, who is he? He's like, well, it's him. He's like, okay. So he sent someone to film me so he would see my, see what I look like to make sure it wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. And then they start negotiating money. But the reason why he did this is because a lot of powerful Syrian business people and business politicians, and often it's the same, they mm-hmm. do both, are in some sort of a black list, which was created by the European Union and the United States.
Sanctions list, right.
They freeze your assets. You can't travel abroad. It's stringent because a lot of these people have foreign businesses and they can't. And he did in Canada. So he's trying to get out of that list by showing goodwill, by paying a lot of money to release a foreign entity, and then hopefully mm-hmm. getting out of that list.
Interesting. That's funny that he would cook up that route to get off a sanction list. But hey, whatever works.
It's one way to do it. It kind of worked in the beginning for him, then it didn't, because governments don't like to be blackmailed. Usually they don't really do well with that.
Did you think that ransom was always the captor's goal, and they were just sort of waiting around for the best offer?
When I would ask why I'm here, they would always tell me the same thing. They say, you can't get out because you're surrounded. We are surrounded by Hezbollah troops, which was true, actually. The front was getting close. I mean, you could feel the war was getting worse and worse where we were. But so they would actually lie always and always tell me that I wasn't kidnapped. They would never tell me you're kidnapped. They always say you're here on your free will, but you know it's not true. But it does make you feel better when you hear that. And they're very smart. They know that. So they're like, oh, so it's okay. But you're not being rational yourself. I knew that I was being kidnapped because it's, you know, it's obvious, but you don't think right. So when they tell you you're not kidnapped, you're like, okay, that's okay. I'm okay. I'm going to be fine. I'm going
to
live.
Yeah. So finally, this individual bought your freedom. They took you to another house for, I believe, 10 days that was larger, a little more comfortable.
No. What happened is I was smuggled back to Damascus. Mm-hmm. And then they smuggled me. It was kind of crazy. But they got me to Damascus, and then he got nervous because what he did was, you know, you're dealing with the rebels, so you never know, with the Bashar government. So he smuggled me back into Lebanon 24 hours later. And then he left after the border, and I went to Beirut with two of his men. And he has, had this incredible apartment on, overlooking the marina of Beirut. And I knew Beirut well, so I knew where I was, and I escaped there and ended up at the French embassy.
Yeah, so you managed to find a hard line, and you made a call, had someone call you back, and all of a sudden, you know, they're telling you, run 100 yards down the street to a hotel, I believe?
Yeah, there was a Four Seasons very nearby, and I knew the area because I'd been there, so I just walked around, and I'm just waiting like this in front of the hotel, and this car shows up, and it's the French police, and they pick me up, and they drive me to the embassy.
You described the anxiety of waiting for release as a fishbone in your throat. When did you finally spit the fishbone out and sort of feel okay?
Not till the next day, because I remember I had a major panic attack, which I've never had before, and I probably will never have that again. When I woke up the next morning at the embassy, at this beautiful room, my brain didn't realize that I was free. So I spent about half an hour in utter panic trying to remember where I was. Now, you see where you are, but it's weird. Your brain was like, could not connect how it felt or where you were. So I had no idea where I was, like completely lost. Wow. And then it kicks back in, and then I was fine.
I can't even imagine. So finally you're out after enduring the hell of 81 days of captivity. But all that time, your parents are dealing with a totally different kind of hell, right? This fear and uncertainty about your situation, worrying about you. Unfortunately, sometimes the way governments interact with families make things worse. They increase that anxiety. They have terrible bedside manner, for lack of a better term, in terms of communicating with people. The United States refuses to pay ransoms. Other governments like France will publicly deny that they pay, but it's clear that they do. It's also difficult for families like yours to know who to talk to in the government. You talk in the book about how it's bizarre that the FBI is handling these cases because they are in charge of missing persons. But why isn't the State Department, right? It was this convoluted system. In fact, some American families were told they could be arrested if they talked about paying for ransom.
So it was like Jim Foley's family. Yeah,
totally fucked up system. The Obama administration ended up conducting a big review of hostage policy and reforming it in 2015. We can get into that more. But first thing I want to ask is, like, how did your family and friends deal with those days? Like, what sort of things practically were they working on to try to get you home?
Well, I got bits and pieces of information after, obviously, I came home. And even recently, I found out some stuff I didn't know. My parents, my mother lives in Mexico. My father lives in Maine. But they had this policy, if I can say, to keep it secret.
Right.
Obviously, the governments would agree with that. So that's the way they want it. Some other families want to make it public. Maybe if such a long time has passed, it's time to do that. But they had a mixed feeling. Dealing with the French government went quite well, I think. It went well. It's just the way it's set up, the interaction, everything was different. And dealing with the U.S. government didn't go well. Now, to be fair to the federal government, it's a huge organization and it's a huge country. And dealing with one individual, it's perhaps more difficult in terms of technicalities, how things are constructed. In Europe, France is a much smaller nation, it's less people. So it's you can have a closer relationship with the government in that sense. Now, you're right, the Obama administration, they try to mend the relationship between the DOJ, for example, and the families, because families were very upset.
Yeah.
And now a question about money. There's always money involved. Often what could happen is the United States can use a third party or a third party in terms of a country or an individual to pay. But usually there's money involved.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money.
I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I think you were probably a little too fair a minute ago to the U.S. government. So some of the reforms they made was basically, you know, we're not going to abandon you. We're going to stand by them. They created a hostage group to coordinate all the disparate parts of government so they're talking to the right people. And, you know, they had to stop needlessly threatening families and telling them, hey, if you negotiate with a terrorist group, you could go to prison. That is crazy.
I think they wouldn't send you to jail. They might sue you.
It's
a threat. The reason why I'm being nice to the federal government, and trust me, it doesn't happen all the time because it's a heavy structure that's cumbersome. But the FBI was very good to me.
Got it.
When I came back, and they helped me get money, there was funds.
To replace some of the equipment.
And I got quite a bit of money and more than I needed, actually, to replace things. And I kept good relations with the FBI, and so that kept So during not so good, but after, I met some good agents, They were very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about these endless debriefings that happened after you got back. There were the French authorities, there were the FBI. Am I debriefing you as we speak, or is this like, was this cathartic writing the book and now it's a little easier to dig into it?
Like I was saying earlier in the interview, I've always been very resilient, so it could backfire for some things. I'll get into that, but it was cathartic. And one of the things that was very cathartic for me is going back to war. Mm-hmm. And when I was kind of getting restless and I was in the U.S., I was shooting, but I was bored and I needed something extra to go back to my original positioning. So when the war in the Ukraine started, then I was like, that's it. I packed my bag. I went to Paris, to my best friend's house, called a buddy of mine who's a famous reporter in Paris. He's an older gentleman. He's in his 50s now. And we just went to Kiev and we covered the war for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about how your parents, your poor parents, man. You get back and they're like, all right, we're looking forward to plan B. Like, you want to teach? What's your next thing? Since then, I counted that you've been to Cairo during the revolution, Ukraine on the Maidan during the revolution, Mosul, very safe place in 2017. So what drew you back? Like, can you just not shake the need to be in these places?
It's a question that's being asked to me, and every time I say the same thing, it's a legitimate question, obviously, and it's like a sickness. That's usually the word that I use. And again, I'm always very realistic when it comes to that, and we all have that bug. I mean, the guys who do this, so soldiers have it too.
Yeah.
You would have soldiers coming back from the front on leave and to see their family and not have that connection with that family. And the only thing they want to do is go back, you know.
Right.
It's kind of the same. It's not entirely because we're not working as in a unit, but it's similar because once you have the war drug in your bloodstream, it's very hard to shake. And even though you know that it's not healthy.
Yeah. As a photographer, I mean, there are these iconic photos that can, I think, summarize a war in a better than any reporting can, right? There's horrifying images of a naked little girl who had just been napalmed in Vietnam, I think like catalyzed opposition to Vietnam. There's the photo of Aylan Kurdi lying dead on the beach, a little Syrian boy. I mean, Do you think about those images and the political impact as part of your job when you're in these places?
It's not a primary thing. I know my work's going to get well published, so that's a direct consequence of that. Now, when it comes to specific photos that were instrumental in shaping my craft, obviously, and it's true for everybody, there are a couple of photographers, World War II shooters, who were operating on the Russian front, on both the German and the Russian side. Mm-hmm. And I found those very appealing because they're rare. They're not very well known. So I'm always looking for something that's a little bit off the beaten path, if I can say. And they're incredible work. And the atrocity of that conflict just makes it even more. So I try to look for something that's a little different.
Got it. You're clear, honest in the book that you get booked on TV to talk about Syria policy. And you're like, I had this situation. I'm not like a policy expert. I'm certainly not either. But you also said, you know, that you felt like Assad's regime, as awful as it is, was the only thing keeping the country from devolving into total chaos. Do you still feel that way sort of a couple years later? And do you have a sense of like what might be a best case scenario for Syria at this point?
No, but I'm doing my second trip to Syria, and this was when the war started, in the beginning of spring 2012. And we were embedded with rebels in northern Syria, a very difficult trip. And already you had a feeling these guys were being, you know, more and more Islamic. And war does that also. And then more foreigners came in. And I talked to CNN, I was on assignment with them, that be careful because I think this is going to be, and it turned out to be true. Of course, the regime of Assad is, it's not a good regime. It's torturing is their specialty. We all know that.
And
however, it is difficult for the United States to sometimes have the higher moral ground because we have supported some of these people. And when it doesn't suit our national interests, we switch sides, and we do that all the time. That's nothing new. I agree with you. But when you add on top of that to have a higher moral ground, it doesn't make it as credible. I think trying to get rid of them was a terrible thing. 600,000 to 800,000 people have died.
Yeah.
Millions are displaced. The country is in complete ruin. Was it worth it? No. Yeah. So, and look at Libya. Libya is the other great example. Gaddafi, yeah, he was crazy, but you could talk to him still, and he held it together. Libya is a complete chaos, and now all the mass migration to Europe is coming through here.
Yeah,
they had a deal with Gaddafi to stop that, and that was the deal.
Yeah.
And now getting rid of him just unlocked it. So they're very stupid policies.
Yeah. Jonathan Opry, thank you so much for joining me today. And the book is The Shattered Lens, A War Photographer's True Story of Captivity and Survival in Syria. We barely got into the harrowing story of those 81 days, so everyone should buy it and read it, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to Pod Save the World. If you like the show, please rate and review us in the iTunes store. It means a lot to me, and it helps the show. Talk to you next week.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.